dust, kicking, kicking down the cobblestones, looking for fun and feeling groovy, kicking, kicking down, kicking down the cobblestones.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining me now is Carl Honoré, author of the book In Praise of Slowness, How a Worldwide Movement is Challenging the Cult of Speed. He has been called the godfather of the slow movement. His most recent book is Under Pressure, Rescuing Our Children from the Culture of Hyperparenting. He also blogs at carlhonoré.com. Welcome to Background Briefing, Carl Honoré.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
And we had an accidental lesson in the virtues of slowness here this last weekend in Los Angeles, where the much hyped by the local media Carmageddon, as it was labeled, did not materialize. There wasn't giant gridlock and panic and hysteria. In fact, there was quite the opposite. There was a quiet over the city. You could hear the birds. The air was clean. People spent the weekend relaxing with their families. It was altogether a very, very worthwhile and pleasant experience. And my only sense is that we should do this more often. Maybe they should shut the freeways down once a week or once a month.
Well, it's not surprising to hear you describe it that way, because it seems to me that we're now so marinated in this culture of speed. We're all so stuck in fast forward. We're all stuck on this, you know, high speed treadmill that we're terrified of the idea of slowness. And the notion that we might have to slow down at some point seems like an automatic Armageddon. But the truth of the matter is that actually slowing down for us, you know, slowing down judiciously, not doing everything as slowly as possible, but choosing the right moments to slow down is the surest way to live a healthier, happier, more fulfilled life. And I think it's not surprising that the moral of the story of the Carmageddon is that people actually quite enjoyed it. If you think of, you know, when we're lying on our deathbeds at the end of our days and we look back, you know, nobody lies on their deathbed and thinks, I wish I spent more time driving my car, or I wish I spent more time at work or shopping. But those are the three things that consume the vast number of our hours. And they're the things that when you're forced to stop driving around and charging about the city like a headless chicken, that you have to let go. And what do you recuperate? What do you rescue when you let that stuff fall by the wayside? You bring back the things that really give life meaning and texture. You know, you spend time with your children. You read them a bedtime story without dashing off to get, you know, to do another errand in the car, or you have a meal with your family in the garden, a barbecue, or you just go for a walk, or maybe you just swing in a hammock for a little while. And those things, I think, are where a lot of joy comes from. And it's not surprising that people you know, reconnect with their inner tortoise and enjoy it when the time comes.
Well, but I'm not sure the lesson will be learned, because clearly the local press, who ginned up all this hysteria, and the city of Los Angeles actually enlisted a couple of big celebrities, Tom Hanks and Ashton Kutcher, to help publicize this event. But the local media, of course, is not the last thing they want to take responsibility for is the excessive hype. And frankly, every time it rains here in Los Angeles, the local media refers to a vast storm heading our way, storm watch, Southern California, we have crews out, and all this kind of stuff. So they by nature operate on hyperbole. But how do we get to your lessons and make this not just an accident, but something that we can kind of weave into our daily lives?
Well, I think the sad truth is that often it takes a real shock to the system, or a wake-up call to make people realize that they've got stuck in fast-forward and that it's doing them real harm. And for many people nowadays, that wake-up call comes in the form of an illness. You know, one day the body just throws in the towel and says, I can't take it anymore, and you have a heart attack, or your hair starts to fall out, or you just can't get out of bed one morning, or maybe a relationship goes up in smoke because you haven't had the time or the tranquility to listen to the other person, to be with them. I think that something, I mean, I'm a natural-born optimist, and I think that sometimes these surprising, serendipitous moments like a Carmageddon that force people to slow down, they may resist up front, but they actually start, once they taste some of the fruits of slowness, maybe they go back into the fray when the highways open up again with slightly different spirits, and maybe they don't drive quite so fast, maybe don't drive quite so often. I mean, I think it's a tough one, because obviously the main thrust of our culture is towards acceleration. It's towards doing more and more, faster and faster, in less and less time. But I think more and more people are beginning to wake up to the fact that that's a kind of folly, and that there is a lot to be gained by shifting gears. By, you know, it's not about, I'm not a fundamentalist of slowness. I love speed. You know, I live in London, which is a city of volcanic energy. I work in the media and I play hockey. You know, I like fast things. But I guess this slow philosophy, if you wanted to sum it up, is about doing things at what musicians call the tempo giusto, you know, the right speed, that every moment, every act, every person has the right time. And if you do things at the right speed, you do them better and enjoy them more. And I think that, you know, whether it's a Carmageddon or whether it's, you know, gas prices going so high that people can't drive as much, anything that just forces us to, you know, shift our view of the world, to knock us out of that groove and to think of things in a different light, I think can ultimately be helpful, maybe.
Again, I'm speaking with Carl Honoré, who is in London, England. He's the author of In Praise of Slowness, How a Worldwide Movement is Challenging the Cult of Speed. And clearly, though, there's a component in capitalism which calls for more consumption, more, and the consequent resource depletion. Every company has to have better quarterly earnings. People are more and more on a kind of treadmill as a result of the system. And the people who were hurt over this weekend were the retailers and the restaurants. They simply didn't get the same business. And I'm sure that'll be a lot of what the reportage is. So, in other words, family life, ordinary human beings were the winners, but retailers were the losers. Now, is there a way to avoid that?
Well, I think in the short term, if we move to a kind of slow culture, there are going to be winners and losers in the short term, absolutely. But I think that in the long run, it's not a zero-sum game. I mean, I think that I'm not an anti-capitalist. I think that capitalism is the best system that we've got. It's just the form of capitalism that we have at the moment, which I think was a kind of turbo capitalism, which puts us all on this never-ending hamster wheel of consumption and debt. And it's pretty clear. I mean, look what happened with the financial crisis. The U.S. government, the U.S. is teetering on the brink of an apocalyptic debt meltdown. This model is broken. The late 20th century, early 21st century capitalism is a broken model. And I think the way forward is to try and find a way where we can consume without consuming manically and frantically. So I think that kind of change is difficult. Some are more difficult. Some are perhaps like Los Angeles, which is so dependent on the car, where people, in order to go out and go to those restaurants and shops and stores that you described, are more likely to need a car than they are, say, in London or Portland, Oregon, or somewhere in Manhattan. But, you know, there's still other ways to get around, to think. I mean, I understand that even in L.A. you're starting to move towards people cycling more. You've got a fantastic climate for it. But these things take time. You can't snap your fingers and change the whole socioeconomic paradigm, sadly. You know, the slow revolution will be slow, inevitably.
Well, what's interesting about, you mentioned bicycles, a bunch of local bicyclists challenged the airliner JetBlue, had a kind of publicity event where they flew people from Long Beach to the San Fernando Valley because the freeway prevented that from happening. And local bicyclists challenged JetBlue that they'd get there quicker, and they did.
Did they?
So it's already happening. But what I think the answer is here, Carl Honoré, again, the author of In Praise of Slowness, How a Worldwide Movement is Challenging the Cult of Speed, is that the solution, you know, in terms of the winners and losers, in terms of people having a better quality of life because they, you know, take some time off, as, by the way, the Europeans do. They have 6 weeks vacation and et cetera. We are much, much more into what you call turbo capitalism here. And I think everybody pays a price in terms of the stress, both within the family and within the workplace. But if in terms of slowness, you also go local, where you shop locally, go to local and support local businesses, wouldn't that be a way around it? In other words, to stay away from the big malls and get more into local, and even at local farmers markets and bartering, you know, these are all possibilities.
They are, and I think the go local movement is very much a strand of what the slow conception of what the future might look like, is getting away from an arrangement where every purchase depends on a whole string of spending, you know, having a car, the insurance, the paying for the gas, churning out pollution, all of this sort of knock-on stuff that comes when we travel great distances to make a simple purchase. And I think there's a great and compelling argument to be made for people to, for capitalism, both in the United States and Europe and elsewhere, to develop a kind of local face. And it's not just an argument, it's actually happening more and more, and it's happening very much in the food world. You mentioned farmers markets, which have just exploded across the United States and Northern Europe. They've always existed in Southern Europe, of course, where they do slow food and food and just without even thinking about it. But in the kind of English speaking world, we seem to have embraced and rediscovered the joys of shopping locally, enjoying food that, you know, food that has a story behind it, food that tastes of something, food that hasn't ravaged the environment to get to our plate, and just the pleasure of walking or cycling to a local market and seeing other people that you know and getting to know the people who give you your food. And these things all contribute to quality of life. They're very hard to measure on a graph or on a spreadsheet, and maybe they don't appear always in the GDP figures for a nation's output, but they are at the core of what quality of life is. You know, that's, we are human beings are social animals, and any kind of social exchange, any kind of social interaction, is going to make us happier, it's going to make us healthier, and ultimately, of course, it'll make us more productive when we go to work at the end of the day or the beginning of the day. So there's there are a lot of benefits to be harvested from going local, and I think you see more and more of it. And I mean, California is on the cutting edge of a lot of that farmers market stuff. And what one of the criticisms people sometimes make of it is that, oh, well, that's, you know, tomatoes are, you know, about however many dollars a pound, it's all very expensive, it's for the elites. And there's, to some extent, that is sometimes true, but often in farmers markets you find, you know, that the price differential isn't that great, and the quality that you get is so much more. And if you look at the recent figures on how much food we throw away, I think I saw recently that certainly in England, I think it's not that different from in the United States, that people are throwing away up to 40% of the food shopping that they buy in an average month. And that's a huge amount, because we have speed. Fast consumption ultimately is a false economy. You know, you go to a big supermarket, you get a big family pack of tomatoes or oranges or whatever, and then it sits at the bottom of the fridge and you don't eat half of it.
You should never put tomatoes in the fridge.
Exactly, yeah, quite. Yeah,
it destroys them immediately. I'm becoming something of an expert here because I'm growing my own tomatoes, and I do them in these big pots on the back patio. And of course, it costs a fortune. They're the world's most expensive tomatoes, but they're worth it because
they taste
so good. I'm also growing passion fruit as well. So, you said earlier, Carl Honoré, that quite often it takes some kind of apocalyptic event for people to wake up and start to slow down and smell the roses, you know. And we had this apocalyptic, phony apocalypse with Carmageddon, which, thanks to the hype of the media, turned out to keep everybody off the roads, and people had a great time at home, and they reinvented themselves if they didn't even realize it. Now, I recall also after 9/11, when the aircraft was shut down, how quiet it was and how different it was. But I think in terms of the apocalypse, if you will, a lot of indications from scientists about global warming that we are indeed facing an environmental apocalypse. So how does this tie into your slowness thing? In other words, can this be a roadmap? Because arguments over carbon taxes and all of this stuff that we're trying to do to address global warming politically is not working. And as you know, the U.S. opted out of Kyoto. It's not working at a political level, the awareness about what's happening. So to me, it has to work at a human level. People have to change the way they live because the politicians are so bankrupt and so in the pocket of the oil companies and the powerful interests. I don't think it's going to happen unless the people lead.
I think that's true. I think we've reached a stage where this has to bubble up from the grassroots, from the bottom up. And it seems to me that the slow creed or the slow philosophy is a very useful lever for getting people to think about how they can live differently in a way that doesn't lay waste to Mother Nature. I mean, there's whatever you think about carbon, global warming and carbon, this, that, and the other. What is indisputable is that the Earth cannot sustain 7, 8, 9, 10 billion people consuming at the rate that the average American consumer consumes today. That's a fact. whatever lobby you belong to, whatever think tank is funding you, that is just a fact. That is, it's just not going to happen. So we need now to be thinking quite seriously about consuming in different ways. And I think part of the problem with much of the green approach, the green movement, the ecological eco lobby, is that it often has a slightly hectoring, lecturing tone, finger wagging and so on, and you can see why that happens, and maybe there's some room for hectoring and finger wagging, but I think that often turns people off, and that what I think is quite hopeful and upbeat about the slow movement is it's saying, okay, hang on a minute, let's turn the coin around, let's turn the argument around and say, well, what do we really want? You know, what would make people happy? What would make people well? What would actually make us, you know, better workers as well in the long run? And that's slowing down, you know, having a good quality of life, enjoying every moment, you know, rather than turning every moment into a race against the clock, savoring the minutes instead of counting them. And if you come in sort of through that door, it can lead you to the same place, which is a different kind of consumption, a different approach to capitalism, a different approach to consumerism. But it comes in through a different door, and a door that I think people find much more approachable. And that may be the lever, you know, that may be the way to push forward, because it does feel like we are in a kind of intellectual gridlock at the moment, with whether it's politicians or business, big business all in one corner, and the environmental lobby in another, and people hurling insults across the chasm and questioning each other's reports and facts and figures. And it just feels like a kind of shouting match in an echo chamber. And I think that's really off-putting. And maybe this sort of thinking about slowing down and doing things better and enjoying life more is a way in that's approachable to all sides, and something that maybe gets away from the traditional right-left divides and some of the old slugging matches of the past.
Well, I think also it would apply to economics and the kind of corporate mentality, if you will, where there's endless books about how to improve the bottom line. But the bottom line is that if your workers are happier and more rested, they're more productive. So maybe corporations should discover the slow movement too.
Exactly, and they are. In fact, when my book first came out, I thought that I would be eviscerated by the corporate world, that it would be just blood on the floor and I would be crucified. But actually the opposite has turned out to be true, because people who are in the, especially the fast-moving industries, the most demanding, the most high-stress, the most high-powered sectors of the economy, these are the people who are on the front line. These are the people who know more than anyone else the damage that too much speed, too much busyness, constant distraction, and overstimulation is doing, not only to their health and private lives, but also to their ability to work well. So you're finding out big companies all over the world, even in the United States, you know, which, as you were saying earlier, is famous for its workaholic hour culture. I mean, big companies like Boston Consulting Group and so on, offering its staff more vacation time and at the same time insisting that they take it, you know, result, staff who are happier, healthier, more productive, who make fewer mistakes, or big high-tech companies suggesting now that we use the off button on our smartphones and our internet connection so that we can put on the brakes a little bit, so we can rest, reflect, recharge. You know, Hewlett-Packard put out some research a little while ago warning that the constant barrage of electronic interruptions, phone, fax, pager, tweet, email, causes our IQ to fall 10 points. And if you know anything about IQ, that's 10 points.
I certainly know that that's the last thing we need in America, is for people to get stupider,
smoking,
because
smoking
I'm
marijuana,
afraid it's already happening.
Or smoking a joint. So you, on one hand, we have this idea that being always on, being constantly connected, answering every phone call on the first ring, is going to turn you into an uber-productive master of the universe, when in fact it's going to turn you into Cheech and Chong. You know, and that's Hewlett-Packard saying,
Switch
off your mobile phones. It's not an aromatherapy cooperative. So I think you know, that's another sign that the tectonic plates are moving below the surface, that even business is starting to say, whoa, things are too fast. You know, it's actually harming the bottom line, and we could goose the bottom line by slowing down judiciously just a little bit at the right moments.
Well, let's hope that people in Los Angeles and perhaps in the rest of the world learn from Carmageddon for this last weekend. And already the city of Bogota shuts its streets down on a Sunday, and people get to enjoy their city. Maybe
I was in Bogota last month, and I'll tell you, it's extraordinary. I mean, it feels like the natural order somehow has been restored. People come out, they talk to their neighbors, they cycle, children play, and it's remarkable. It's like a kind of scene from a medieval painting, and it's actually joyous. And Bogota is a pretty chaotic, messy, anarchic city in the developing world. If Bogota can pull something like that off, then why not Los Angeles?
Well, I thank you so much for talking with us today, Carl Honoré.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Carl Honoré, author of the book In Praise of Slowness, How a Worldwide Movement is Challenging the Cult of Speed. His most recent book is Under Pressure, Rescuing Our Children from the Culture of Hyperparenting. He also blogs at carlhonore.com. That's carlhonore.com. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I would like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. You can sign up for podcasts and contact me at ianmasters.com. I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.